Welcome to the Live Courageously podcast show. I'm your host, John Duffy, and Live Courageously has been the conscious theme of my life for the last 4 years since the beginning of the pandemic in 2020. Courage is resistance to fear, mastery of fear. There's something contagious about someone who is courageous. Today's show is with a courageous and adventurous friend, Jeffrey Sanow, and I'm really looking forward to having this conversation, and you'll find out why. Jeffrey brings advanced CIA-inspired leadership training to the corporate world. Jeffrey brings a wealth of experience and expertise in the leadership of intelligence operations, particularly in leveraging civilian business tools for military and intelligence purposes. His extensive tenure at the Central Intelligence Agency gives him a deep understanding of intelligence methodologies and practices. Additionally, his proficiency as a social skills instructor indicates his ability to effectively communicate and train others in complex subjects, which is crucial in the field of intelligence, where effective interpersonal communication and relationship building are paramount. Mr. Sanow's journey exemplifies a remarkable dedication to service, continual learning, and the cultivation of a nuanced understanding of intricate global issues. Hailing from a humble upbringing on a small farm in Ohio, Mr. Sanow's formative experiences have molded him into a distinguished professional, starting as a Peace Corps volunteer and following with over two decades of service within the Central Intelligence Agency. With that, let me say greetings, Jeffrey, and thank you for joining us. And this is a first for me. I've never met a CIA intelligence officer before, and I've never had one on my show. So with that, I'd like to ask two questions to kick off the show. The first is, how did we meet personally? Because, you know, that's something I always like to let the audience know.
Well, we met personally at the grand reveal of the Mindatorium. Was the first time that we met. And being men of the same generation and the same basic mold, if I can use that term, we quickly learned to respect each other.
Yeah, I it was an interesting evening with a lot of great stuff, and our conversation was very fascinating. I have to put it that way. You're very fascinating, your background, and obviously when I found out just a little bit of what you do, I was like, God, I gotta have you on my show. So it was a good night. I was really glad to have met you. You know, my second question is, before I dive deeper into your background and your experience, is what would you say Live Courageously means to you personally, based on your life?
Not letting fear stop you from going where your heart and brain are driving you. So some people, that's going to be their career in nursing, just using that as an example. Some people, it's going to be their willingness to travel to far off places and or have experiences that they normal people wouldn't do for whatever reason. And the ability to manage your fear is what it's all about. And you don't let it dominate you. That's the secret, in my view, of living courageously is, yeah, it's okay to be afraid. I mean, if you're a skydiver, you should be afraid. I'm a scuba diving instructor. I need to be very afraid that my equipment's not going to work. But you manage that fear by making sure your equipment is sound, by having a good dive buddy, by following good time-tested practices and principles. That's how you manage that fear. And then you can go on to, as you say, live courageously.
I like that. I like that answer because it is. It's not that we don't have fear, because fear is a warning to us in a dangerous situation, but we either manage the fear and then we proceed in the face of the fear. But it isn't like we don't feel the fear. We have to fear, recognize it, because, like I said, it's a warning sign. So I love your answer about that. So let me tell me about you, Jeffrey. You started in humble background and you joined the Peace Corps first. Why? What got you to start volunteering and beginning to live a life of service?
Well, there were a couple things. The first is my mother, who by the time she was 25, I believe, or 26, had four kids. And she had always wanted to go on Project Hope. which is the hospital ship that goes to a lot of the less advantaged areas of the world. Now, there's many ships like that now, but back in, you know, the 1960s and 70s, there was one. It's called Project Hope. So that made me want to be willing. And actually, when I made my decision, she supported me because I said, I don't want to be like you, Mom, and say, I wish I'd done this. It's like, he's totally on board. The other thing, again, has to do with my parents. And I don't like to dwell on this, but I had a crappy childhood. Parents were divorced, remarriages, stepsisters on this side, stepbrothers on that side, and the whole nonsense that goes with all of that was enough to make me want to leave the country. Basically, I was running away from home. When I was 20 years old, I was standing at a bus stop at Ohio State University, and I saw a little advertisement there in the bus stop for the Peace Corps, and it was in the offices about 100 feet from where I was standing. So I thought, hey, let's go talk to that guy. And half hour later, somehow I didn't make my class that day, but I left with the application and submitted my application. Even though I didn't have a college degree at the time, I had a very strong mechanical agricultural background. And so they accepted me. And from there, I took on Livingston. You know, I decided, okay, let's go figure this out. So I wanted to go to Africa. I think the reasons for that, I actually just figured it out having been to Uganda recently, had a lot to do with National Geographic magazine.
Interesting.
So what kind of pictures did National Geographic magazine have from Africa?
Safaris, stuff like that, maybe?
Topless women.
Oh, okay. I was wrong.
I was a young kid, and I thought, hey, let's run away someplace and have lots of beautiful topless women. That's maybe not the best reference I would ever want to give, and people watching this are probably thinking I lost my mind. But as a 17-year-old, 18-year-old, 20-year-old, you know, you got lots of things going on in your head.
Well, at least there's that honesty there.
Sometimes that's good, sometimes it's not. Anyway, so I went to Tunisia, which turned out to be North Africa, which is a very different environment than deepest, darkest Africa that Livingston walked across. It's Arab and it's Muslim.
Correct.
And so that was my first experience outside of the U.S. in Africa. And, you know, I enjoyed it. I worked on farm machinery. Everybody was wonderful. I learned to speak Arabic and made some good friends. Still stay in touch with them to this day. So that was great. And then at the end of my 2 years, nothing had changed for me back home. I still had Ohio State University looking at me and my family. And it's like, okay, let's go someplace else with Peace Corps. So I applied for a second tour, which is very easy. And this time I went to Gabon. Gabon is right on the equator of Africa. It is deepest, darkest Africa. And when I told my mother I was going to Gabon, she was really excited for me. And she said that that's where Albert Schweitzer's hospital is. And my response was, who? Once again, annoying my mother. Albert Schweitzer was a very well-known doctor and pioneer in Africa for setting up hospitals. Again, as a nurse, she appreciated that. I wasn't a nurse, and she didn't appreciate that. I didn't appreciate that. Anyway, so I went to Gabon for another year and a half. It was supposed to be 2 years. While I was there, I met a professor from Sam Houston State University in Huntsville, Texas. And he promised me he would help me get enrolled if I chose to transfer. He would find me a place to stay and would find me a job with the university. So he left and went back to Texas. And then I had more family shenanigans that made me leave short of tour to go back and try and figure out what was going on with my family. Then 2 months later, I drove down to Huntsville, Texas, and enrolled in university, finished up my bachelor's and my master's. And first job out of college was at a turkey processing plant in Waco, Texas. After about 2 days of that job, it's like, okay, this is not what my mama raised me to do. So
at least you figured that out quick.
If you've ever been in a turkey processing plant, if it takes you too long to figure that out, you're not paying attention.
I worked in the post office for 5 years. It's not as bad as a turkey processing place, but boy, 5 years was five too long years. Trust me.
Yes, sir. So, I started going through what the Wall Street Journal had, the job ads. Remember those?
Oh, yeah.
And what came out once a week. And so I came across an application for the CIA. I asked my wife if I could apply. Her only restriction was I could not carry a gun. Okay. I never carried a firearm overseas. Huh. And I applied. I went through the very, very lengthy vetting process. I'm sure we're all glad they do a good job of vetting people who are applying. And then eventually was hired and went into the deep cover program.
Now, when you made that decision, okay, obviously anything's better than working in a turkey processing plant. That's clearly true, right? But, yes, you know, still, that's kind of a unique choice to go work in the CIA. I mean, I may be wrong. I did a little research. There's about 27,000, as far as we know, employees. Obviously, there's probably more. But so it's not a lot of people apply and a lot of people get in. And like you said, the vetting process is really strong. So it's a small group of people. What made you want to do that? And did you have any reservations about that? Or like, well, this is like dangerous and I don't want to do this. What was going through your head at that age in making that decision?
I was looking for a continued adventure.
Okay.
And I didn't see it anyplace else. And, you know, I'd applied for some other jobs while I was going through that process, but none of them came through or that I wanted. So this just had an appeal. It was, you know, serve your country, you know, that's got the mystique that goes with it that we in the 1970s and 80s, I'm sure you can appreciate. We hadn't been quite as badly mistreated as we seem to be being these days. So it was just an opportunity to do something different. As I said, mastery of fear is simply being afraid, but doing it anyways. So I give my wife credit for mastering her fear of what I was going to do and where we were going. But I hate to say, it sounds like I'm saying, oh, it's just one of those things. It seemed like a fun idea at the time.
Right. And so we're going to dive into, so what, for people who don't know, and there may be people who don't know, what is the CIA? Obviously, it's not a domestic law enforcement branch like the FBI. It's international. What is it and what does it do?
The CIA's principal role is to provide intelligence to policymakers. It is part of the executive branch, and we respond to requirements from policymakers, presidents, vice presidents, congressional leaders, congressmen. We respond to their requests for intelligence information. There is a great deal of information out there, and much of the what they're looking for is readily available. It's called OSINT, which stands for Open Source Intelligence. In other words, you read the newspaper, you read the magazine, you read the website. But there's also that need for classified intelligence. There's also a need to know what is the president thinking, not our president. What is the president? I'm going to pick on Bashar Assad because he's gone now. What is the president of Syria thinking? What is his planning? Why is he organizing his troops this way? And that's not going to be available to the public or in any type of magazine or newspaper. So it requires what's known as HUMINT, which stands for human intelligence. And as an aside, the name of my book, which I just finished writing, is called HUMINT for Humanity. We'll come back to it later.
Yes, let's definitely come back to it later.
But the whole idea is that the CIA provides intelligence, analysis, and recommendations to policymakers that they can't get anyplace else. You have SIGINT, which is signals intelligence, which is the branch of NSA. Sometimes they work with the CIA. Everybody's listening to everything out there these days. So that's that type of intelligence. But you need to have that cream, if I can use that term, of what is the president thinking? Why does he want to do that? How can we influence those policies? And these, I'm talking foreign presidents, not domestic. So the CIA is by definition a foreign intelligence collection operation. We do have offices throughout the United States because we've got lots of foreigners here. Again, it still is an intelligence collection operation. They are very strict, no matter what you see on TV, on not collecting against Americans or speaking to an American where that American does not know who they're talking to. We are required by law to inform them. Now, first go around, you meet somebody at a subway and you're chatting and, oh, this guy might be interesting. You don't have to tell them the first time. Second meeting, you have to tell them. So if it's an American citizen, so that they know who they're talking to, or you don't talk to them. And we would pull back from that just because it wasn't worth the headache if they're a U.S. citizen, because, oh my goodness, the paperwork, and it's so hard to justify because the law is very strict and those laws are in place for a good reason. We're not here to spy on U.S. citizens. Frankly speaking, that's the FBI's job and that's local law enforcement job or the DEA's job or whomever. Our job was against the foreign target.
Now, you know, you come in, you get trained, you didn't start at the level you were. There's two things about your career. One is that you spent 26 years, is that correct, in the CIA? 23. So that's a long time. You know, not everybody stays that long in the CIA. So that's like a smaller handful make it that long or stay that long. And then two, you moved into being an intel officer. What does that mean? Because obviously collecting intelligence can be collected in an office. It can be collected out in a country. What is some of the things you experienced personally? How did you become an intelligence officer? And then what did you do on that journey as an intelligence officer that you can share with us?
I was hired as an intelligence officer. I didn't become one. Okay. Yes, sir. Basically, you have intelligence officers, you have analysts, and you have support.
Okay.
Basically. So I was an intelligence officer. And frankly speaking, let me give praise to the reports and the analysts back there that supported my work and the administrative folks that supported my work. They all are fantastic people. And, you know, we see, you know, if you follow the James Bond way of thinking, it's just one guy doing a job. No. It's one guy supported by an entire team doing a job. And they do great. So I went through the training to become an intelligence officer because there are certain ways that they teach us to do things. There are certain ways they teach us to protect ourselves. Our biggest source of protection is in the ability to detect surveillance. And we go through a lot of surveillance detection training. Some of it's really fun because we're doing it in the U.S. and the FBI are the ones, they're practicing doing surveillance while we're practicing detecting surveillance. And it can be quite funny when they make a mistake because their job, frankly, is much harder than ours. And it's fun to laugh at them. And of course, there is a rivalry.
Does that happen down at Quantico? Is that where that goes on?
Mostly in, I would just say, Virginia. Quantico is where FBI's training ground is.
Right.
Ours is also in Virginia, but a lot of the specialized training that I went through, the more advanced training, is done in the Northern Virginia area.
So you're being trained, they're actually surveilling you, and you're being trained to be able to detect that you're being surveilled and what their techniques are and how they're surveilling you. Is that correct? Is that part of the training you went through?
Yes, sir. But part of the trick is to detect surveillance without them knowing that you have detected them.
Correct.
Because who looks for surveillance besides bad guys?
Right.
So they have to know, they can't know that we detected it. So we have, again, methods and training that allows us to, if we detect it, how do we abort the operation? Things of that nature.
Now, did you, once you went through all that training, how much of your time was spent in the U.S. and how much did you go on a venture to other countries?
The training in the U.S. was more or less 3 years, and that encompassed a lot of OJT training, a lot of specific training.
What is that, OJ?
On-the-job training. On-the-job.
Uh-huh.
And so, plus, they bored the tears out of us by making us listen to the bureaucrats that would come and talk to us. Remember, you got a bunch of 20-something case officer wannabes, and we're having to listen to this bureaucratic weenie talk to us. So what are you going to do? Anyway, and then from there, I went to South Asia as my first overseas tour. It was my now ex-wife's first overseas experience. So I started at the bottom because everything from there is up. And she was a trooper. I have to give credit to her. In fact, my book is dedicated to her for everything she did to help me. So then I went over there. I was there for 3 years. And then that was the time that had been agreed upon.
And so, was that in one country in Southeast Asia or was it multiples?
One country in South Asia.
Okay, one country.
And then from there, I went back and did some language training and went to Southeastern Europe. Okay. I was there enjoying the Mediterranean. And I was there for 2 years. That was very nice, except the company that I was working for collapsed. So I had to leave the country. I went back to Texas because my now ex-wife had family there. And while I was there, I pursued graduate certification in telecommunications management. Now, remember, this is before the internet. This is
wait. You mean there was a time before the internet?
I know, hard to believe.
Hard to believe, right?
Could you imagine a time when we didn't have these?
No, I don't. Oh God!
Don't you remember when they used to be connected by a cord to the wall?
Oh man, you remember the first portable phones that were like big blocks that people carried and put in their car? And in New York, they would break into the car and steal them.
That doesn't surprise, you know, the size of a lunchbox.
Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed.
Yep. So at any rate, I had completed the telecommunications management program. It was a 5-course master's, because I already had a master's degree. I didn't want another master's degree. So I got to take the core courses, which gave me a certification in telecommunications management. And then from there, I went over to the Middle East and spent the next 5.5 years, almost 6 years in the Middle East, doing God's work.
Well, I want to get to some of that, but I'm going to play a video of yours in a minute. But how many languages? Obviously, you said you learned Arabic when you were in the Peace Corps. Was that the two languages, English and Arabic, that you learned, or did you learn any additional?
Arabic was North Africa. French was Central Africa. And then I had a couple other languages that I learned along the way, just so I could order lunch.
All right. Well, let me share this video because it shares a fun story of yours with everybody. And then we'll come back to go a little bit deeper into what you can share with us. So let me do that. And let's see if I can get this up there. And yes, I think that's it. Hold on 1 second. And so the thing about sharing videos, they're all fun. Okay. Thank you.
Imagine the leadership, teamwork, and dedication that went into the successful CIA operation to rescue the six hostages from Iran in 1979, as portrayed in the 2012 movie Argo.
Or you could just send in training wheels and meet them at the border with Gatorade.
It's gonna take a miracle to get them out.
While the movie portrays much of the mayhem and confusion that constitutes government action or inaction, it also shows the extraordinary heights to which CIA operations officers must reach to design and execute successful operations. This is the path I followed and was groomed for success by the most talented and successful operations officers in the CIA. While we all start with the same skill, leadership and dedication allows us to achieve different levels. I achieved the highest level of intelligence officer in the CIA, giving me the opportunity to supervise some of the most complex global intelligence operations. If you're looking for a speaker to increase your team's performance, then hire me, Jeffrey Sano. I will work with your team to help them achieve stunning success, where failure is not an option.
Nice video.
Yeah, who put that together? That was good. It was excellent. I think that gives us a little bit of idea of you, and we're going to talk more about that, what you're doing in the future as a speaker and as a trainer for corporations. But, you know, one, Argo was an amazing movie. I mean, that particular operation was just brilliant, being able to rescue those people from Iran at that time. But, you know, let's just pivot back to you. You know, you said you spent a bunch of times in the Middle East, six years in the Middle East. And obviously that seems like maybe of definitely more dangerous than Western Europe, probably. So what can you share about that, or what would you like to share about stories, or any story you would like to share with us about what that work was at that time that you were engaged in?
Let me first just reflect a minute on that movie.
Sure.
Arguably the most accurate movie that I've seen when it comes to what does the CIA do? How do we operate? How are we successful? And that movie, it's based on a true story, as we all know. And it does reflect some of the silliness that goes on when you have to sit down in front of congressional aides and try and explain something to them. And they are much more concerned with the perception and getting reelected or getting their boss reelected than they are with the details of an intelligence operation. And you will be asked some of the silliest questions. And you got to answer them because they can throw the purse strings. You don't want to get the congressional committees angry at you.
So are you saying you can't tell them what you really think?
No. that would be an expensive mistake.
Correct.
And, you know, I assume they're all doing God's work. We're all doing God's work. They're just on a different plane than I am.
It's a nice way to put it.
The work that I did in the Middle East allowed me to travel all over that part of the world. There were always exciting times when I got taken into secondary or I got stuck at the border, and you just kind of got to sit and wait those things out. Now, one thing the agency does is it takes very, very good care of people like me, and they keep an eye on us. We have to ask approvals to do a lot of things. Yeah, it's kind of a pain, but the matter of fact is it's to keep you safe, because it's much cheaper for them to be a pain in my neck than for me to be arrested or kidnapped or something, and then they have to deploy a whole lot of more resources. So you have to learn to do those things. I was traveling with my youngest daughter, and we'd gone to Oman. And we drove in and did the work that needed to be done, and we were driving back. Unfortunately, there was no exit immigration point for leaving the country we were in going into Oman, but there was one leaving Oman going back into the country where we wanted to go. What that meant was I did not have exit stamps in our passports. And so because I didn't exit the country legally, I couldn't enter the country legally. So my daughter and I were sitting on this bench outside the immigration office for about 2 hours while they figured out what to do. And eventually they were like, yeah, we can't stamp you back in, but yeah, go ahead and go. And they let us back into the country. And those were some fun times. There's other parts of the Middle East that are just fascinating. I talk about Lebanon, where we are very, very active. As a nation, we are very, very active in the Middle East right now. We're trying to figure out what's going to happen with Israel, what's going to happen with Syria, which just went through a horrific change. Now, Bashar Assad, he was not a prince. He was not even really a nice guy. He was a dictator. But he protected religious minorities because he comes from a religious minority. He and his family were Alawites. So I'm sure you know how important Damascus is to our Christian heritage. The foundation of Christianity, Damascus is the second most important city, second only after Jerusalem, when it comes to Christianity. And so he did a good job of protecting the religious minorities in Syria. If you read Acts chapter 9, it talks about the street called Straight, where after Paul, Saul went blind, and the bishop Ananias was told to go to the street called Straight and find this man. The street called Straight still exists. I've walked down the street called Straight. I've been to Ananias's underground church, the place where Saul, now Paul, was baptized. Huh. If you go north of Damascus, there are some monasteries that were built by Emperor Justinian I before Muhammad of Islam was even born. And yet, they have now had jihadis take over Syria. You remember what happened when the jihadis took over Afghanistan and they destroyed the Buddha statue that had been carved into the wall of the mountain. It was like 200 feet tall, and they simply destroyed it.
So, you know, and it's funny you see, because I think most people in America don't, because it's part of our culture, don't even remember that happened. Don't even have not paid attention to what they did there in Afghanistan. And because things move so fast and we just forget, you know, it seemed like that was 8,000 years ago and it wasn't. But you're right. Syria is a unique country, and maybe you can address that. The amount of, and as I was reading about it, the amount of both religious and ethnic minorities is huge. All the varieties of religions that exist in Syria and ethnic groups that exist in Syria, it's very unique. It's a very unique country.
Yes, sir. And again, I'm not defending Bashar Assad or his father, Hafez al-Assad. They were dictators of the worst kind.
Correct.
But they did protect all of the minorities. They did protect the religious minorities. I've been to the monastery that was built, I was referring to, in Sednaya, which is about 30 miles north of Damascus. And it's beautiful. It's stunning. And it's, 1,500, 1,600 years old. So that's how long Christianity was practiced there. And again, it was started by the Emperor Justinian. And you know, one of the things about that, in that monastery, there's said to be a painting of Mary done by Saint Paul. And this speaks to me very deeply because it's my religious history. No, I'm not a preacher. I'm not a religious fanatic. None of that good stuff. But I was raised in the church my entire life. I'm a good Lutheran, if there is such a thing. Just ask my wife. My wife's Catholic. So. my pastor says Catholics make the best Lutherans, and you have to think about that for a while to enjoy the humor in it. At any rate, so Syria had a very big mix of people, a lot of different ethnicities, a lot of different religions. Yes, Islam was the dominant religion, but it was not the only one, and all the rest of them were protected. There's a chapel called St. Paul's Chapel, right close to where the street called Straight is. And supposedly it was built at the location where Paul was lowered over the wall so the Jews wouldn't kill him. So, I mean, when you can start going places, it's talked about in the Bible, that place has been around a long time. And that place has an important history to us. So
now, with this overthrow of Assad by this group, they are a Sunni Muslim. He was Shia, but Alawite, right? And Sunnis make up 70% of, from what I researched, 70% of Syria. This Shia was 13%. But with this group, it's a group that's been labeled a terrorist group, and they are the ones who've now taken over. What can you tell us, as much as you can now? What's your take on where are we in Syria? What is the, you know, obviously they replace a dictator with potentially a worst Islamic terrorist organization. So what is the history foretell for Syria at the moment?
The story it tells, in my view, is not very good. It's not very positive. That doesn't mean it's going to last. Again, it depends on administrations. Our administration plays a big role in that. The U.S. still has troops, I believe, in Syria. I believe Russia still has troops there. Right now, the Israelis are busy bombing the daylights out of any possible weapon stores that were in Syria that could fall into the hands of jihadis. They've bombed Syria some 300 or 400 times over the past couple of days. And what they're trying to do is eliminate the possibility that the Islamist jihadis will be able to get their hands on chemical weapons and missile delivery systems and things of that nature. So I'm not optimistic, but I can also say that there's so much confusion going on right now. I hate to go down the political road. We currently do not have a strong political leadership. And so all the nonsense is going to happen before, what's the day, January 20th? Is that inauguration day?
Yes, it is.
So I think you're going to see a lot of silliness going on for the next month while everybody tries to do all the stupid things that we don't want them to do, because they recognize from the prior Trump administrations that when he says, don't do this or I'll smack you, he generally means it.
Well, I think you having an insight into it, you know, has a little bit more weight to it, because I think most people don't know anything about Syria and what's going on. And, you know, the media right now seems to portray that somehow the Islamics who had taken over the country are going to become moderate overnight. Somehow I've never seen that happen, but I guess that's what the media thinks is going to happen. But I don't think that reality is ever done on their own volition. They don't become moderate because they want to become moderate. That's not how it works.
They said the same thing about Afghanistan.
Correct.
And we saw how that turned out. And already I'm reading reports about women being directed to wear a headscarf and cover their head, whether they're Muslim or not.
Right.
So, no, I see... there being a lot of hardship in Syria right now. I don't see a lot of good options. And I think, again, we have to remember the importance of Syria to our history and culture, because if you lose your history and culture, you lose your country. I mean, that's where we came from originally. And so it's very difficult to see how this is going to have a positive outcome any more than Iran did when the Shah fell and Khomeini went in there and took over. It hasn't gone particularly well for your average Iranian. And they're hoping to have some overthrow of the government there now in Iran. So you've had so many people with so many fingers in the pie and being destructive and supporting terrorist organizations, because it's much easier to have your favorite terrorist organization go in and cause a problem than it is to send your own military in. That was the whole idea behind Hamas's attack on October 7th. That's the whole idea of the bombardments from Hezbollah in southern Lebanon. No one can attack at a country. Now, the Iranians have learned to their dismay that the Israelis will smack back and very effective in that. So I don't know how it's going to turn out. I wish I could predict it. I don't think it's going to turn out nicely. I think we're going to continue to see a lot of the same kinds of brutality against people that we don't want to see. And yet we don't know how to not have it happen.
I hear you. I'm going to try, because I knew this was going to happen. I'm struggling to cover all the things I want to cover with you, but I want to cover one thing here. I'm going to throw up a picture of you right here. And, you know, I read about after October 7, you felt that you needed to get in back into the fight and get out of retirement. And so this picture is just one picture of an event that you were at. But tell us a little bit about why did that motivate you, and what did you choose to start doing after the October 7th massacre in Israel? And I got to see, I went to a Nova exhibition in LA, which was about the massacre, very powerful exhibition. But tell us about what drove you into getting back into the fight, as you put it.
As a white American male, I grew up, my post-World War II, my father and uncle fought in World War II. I didn't have to. I was lucky, and I didn't go to Vietnam. I was born in that period when they did away with the draft before they reinstated the Selective Service. So I didn't have to worry about any of those things. But just as a adult with a conscience, how could anyone justify the murder of babies being cut out of the mother's womb, being put in ovens? The horrific things that they did on October 7th defies description and imagination. And I don't want to watch the movies that they're making out of them, because it'll just make me cry and get really angry. And I don't need that to make me really active. So when I heard what happened, because your generation and my generation saw the fallout from the Holocaust, and we've been around long enough to know how horrific the gas chambers were. We haven't forgotten that history. People younger than us may not have learned that much about that in history, but you and I learned about that when we were in school. So to tolerate the murder of 1,200 civilians and the kidnapping of another, 500 or 600, something like that, and to think that that could be okay in any environment. Now, you want to join the military, we're going to train you to fight, we're going to give you a gun, we're going to put you in a tank, and you're going to go to war, and you might die. That's military to military. That's how we fight wars. We don't fight wars by killing babies. Or pregnant women, or grandma. Well, that's not how we fight wars. So when I saw that that's how they wanted to fight the war, it was an easy decision for me to say, what can I do to get back in this fight? The picture that you were showing there was from an Israel Bonds event. Israel Bonds is a way to invest in Israel. They give a very good return on you buy a bond, a 2-3, whatever, 5-year bond, and they give a fair return on it. They've been operating in the United States since, I think, the inception of the country, to be honest with you. So that is just, we can't let this sit. There's a saying that I have on my emails, and I'm going to get it wrong, even though I've read it a million times, but it was by Dietrich Bonhoeffer. I just saw his movie, by the way. Very good movie.
Yes, excellent movie. I saw it as well. Bonhoeffer.
God will not hold you faultless. To not act is to act. To not speak is to speak. So for anybody that thinks they don't want to be involved, what they're saying is that's okay what happened. And for me, I couldn't do that. And I've tried to live by those words. Where if there is something wrong, I will step up to the plate. And, you know, maybe I'll have a problem one day if I see something going on the street. I mean, I'm sure you've seen it just being out there, some guy being a dummy, saying stupid things or threatening to hit a woman. I don't let that go by. I'll go over there and stand and look just long enough to get the guy to calm down and realize that this is not going to go the way he wants it to because he's out in public. And I just, when I read what happened, there was just no way I couldn't do something. I couldn't try and be more involved. I couldn't try and help college students that are threatened for the simple reason that they're Jewish. I can't tolerate that. That's so wrong. This is a country, our country is based on religious freedom. They have the right, Muslims have the right, Lutherans have the right, Catholics have the right to be the religion they want to be and to practice it as they see fit. And anyone that tries to intrude on that is violating our very constitution, and that can't be allowed. So yes, I became very active in doing that. I've set up a 501c3 called Save Our Students because I'm trying to get things organized on college campuses. College campuses, quite frankly, don't really need a lot of help. Now, there were some Ivy League campuses that needed a lot of help, and they removed those presidents, and a lot of that has come back around. But we have large populations, Jewish student populations, at other major universities, and they have done a reasonably good job of not letting these violent acts go forward. I'm not saying it hasn't happened at all. It has happened to some few places. I'm pretty glad it hasn't happened at a lot of places because the universities know that there is no tolerance for that.
Here's where they can contact you. That's your website.
Yes, sir.
And this is also your email as well, that they can contact you as well. But going back to that, what's the name of the organization, the 501c that you just set up?
Save Our Students, SOS.
Save Our Students. Excellent. So what else, and people, I recommend if people, it's going to be in the theater right now, Bonhoeffer, that people go check out that movie. It's an excellent movie. The Nova exhibition, which was in LA, is now going to open up in Miami. So if anybody is in Miami, I recommend that you go watch that Nova exhibition. You can check it out online. It is one of the most powerful things. I went through the thing, and you go through room after room, and they recreated the actual massacre, and you, everything is there, the burnt out cars, the tents. Seeing that was probably second or third most emotional thing after seeing 9/11, when I went to the 9/11 after it happened that December. But to see that horror of people willing to do what you said, to kill babies, to rape women, to just kill young people, and to celebrate in that massacre was insanity, total insanity and evil on a level that we don't get to experience in our life. And luckily so, but so powerful. So good for you for doing that, Jeffrey. What else would you want to add anything else? And I want to pivot to what you're trying to do now. I mean, that's the other thing that I'd like to pivot to. Some of what you're going on. I'll throw up some pictures. Here's a picture of you speaking, by the way. But here's you giving a speech. I believe it's at a church. You have anything else you want to say on that? Or now we'll pivot into what you're doing in the world besides that Save Our Students. What else are you doing with your speaking, with your leadership, with your motivation? And we'll get a little bit into what's the next phase of your life right now.
The next phase of my life is to speak on and coach on leadership. In the agency, believe it or not, they take us through some very significant training. They discovered in, I think, about the mid-1970s that they had really poor leadership, generally speaking. And so they put in a bunch of training programs. I was fortunate enough to go through many of them. One of the things about being an operations officer is the skill it takes to be a good operations officer. It's not the same as the skill as it takes to lead good operations officers. It's a completely different dynamic. And so I was fortunate that I had a boss when I first became a branch chief who coached me on the best ways to do that, on how do you work with an individual? And that was pretty much what he said, was I had to learn how each individual officer that was working for me thought. What do they need? Do they need a lot of warm, fuzzy greetings? I used to, everything we did is an email. And so I would send out my emails, and the first paragraph was always, how's the wife or husband? How are the kids? Did they, blah, 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 personal stuff. And I had one lady who was in Asia come up to me when she was back in the States and say, yeah, you don't have to do that with me. Okay, saves me time and money. So Right. You have to learn, what does each employee want? And you have to let them fail. That's one of the things that I talk about in my book, is you have to empower people to succeed, but then you have to allow them to fail, because failure happens and we got to keep going. Now, obviously, if you're failing all the time, that's a different discussion. But certainly you're going to have operational issues in any world, the business world or the intelligence world, that are not going to work out. So obviously you put everything in place to be successful, but you're going to fail once in a while. And I will share one story. I'm trying to make sure I can do this. We were monitoring weapons of mass destruction and the components with that. And I had an analyst come to me and say, you know, we've got this shipment of computer components coming from this country in Asia, probably going to Iran. But I'm pretty sure it's already left. It's en route. I don't think we can do anything. My response was, we swing at every pitch. And this analyst was great. I love her to death. And so I very politely said, oh, no, you get that email out today. If you have any trouble getting that email out, you tell me and I will go over and talk, because we have to coordinate things with the different divisions. So lots of people have to approve that email. And I said, if you have any trouble getting that email out, you come see me and I'll make sure that it goes. We got the email out. And when I showed up to the office the next day, she very happily came to me and said, we got it. We turned it around. She was empowered to succeed and she was empowered to fail. Had she come to me and said, we didn't get it in time. Okay, we didn't get it in time. But that's not on her, not on the individual, because she was as dedicated and hardworking as any other of the rather large group of analysts I had working for me. And she did everything right. She did everything she could. If the system doesn't allow us to be successful, well, okay, we failed. But she did everything necessary and we were successful. And I'm pretty sure she got an award for that success because of what she went through to get it out and get it turned around.
That's great. Here is a flyer of the speaking topics that you're going to be speaking on, or the many topics that you speak on. I don't know if it covers everything, but this is a flyer for you put up here, and the speaking topics on leadership and all the different areas, your bio and everything. So that's up on the screen. What is the name of your book? Remind us the name of the book. When is it coming out? I assume it'll be on Amazon. When is the release date? And tell us about that.
So I just finished the writing part of the book.
Okay.
Literally 2 days ago. And
you're ahead of me. And then now you're inspiring me. I got to finish mine. But yeah, thanks.
It took 4 years.
Oh, boy.
And I put it off for a long time. And then starting back in about June, I went to a book writing service. Even though I had already written it, I knew it needed work. And so they worked with me, they edited it, and they would say, okay, change this, change that, fix this, fix that. Anything printed has to be approved by the CIA. So I'm not giving away secrets. And I'd submitted one copy to them. And of course they sent it back and they'd taken the black line through a lot of the fun stuff. So I went back and I had to revise it significantly. And what I ended up making it focus on for the first part is, let's take a look at some of the places that I've been and some of the experiences that I, or more importantly, my wife and daughters had while we were overseas doing this or that. And one of the favorite ones has to do with getting a box delivered in South Asia. My wife's parents had sent a Christmas box over, and, you know, they brought a slip to the house that said, yeah, you got a box, but it's too big for us to deliver. Okay, in South Asia, they carry refrigerators on mopeds, and they're telling us this box is too big for them to deliver? You got it. What on earth did they send us, a tractor? So my wife, God bless her, took her passport down to the post office, and they looked at the certificate and looked at her passport and said, well, ma'am, this box is addressed to somebody else. That's not your name. They'd addressed it to our one-year-old granddaughter, their granddaughter. So it's like, no, sorry, we can't give it to you. Okay. So she had to go back home, pick up my 1 year or maybe a year and a half old daughter, take her and her passport down and go, you know, again, wait in line and get up there. And again, okay, here's my 1.5 year old daughter who's kicking and screaming. Here's her passport. Please let me have the box. So they bring out this box, and it's a medium sized box. It's nothing big. And she picks it up and thinks, okay. So they get it in the car and come home, and she opens it, and the box is empty except for one piece of wrapping paper.
Wow.
They'd stolen all the Christmas presents out for our kids.
Oh my gosh.
And yet she had to go through all that aggravation.
Get the empty box. Wow.
Get an empty box. And this is why, quite frankly, I dedicate my book to my ex-wife. Yeah, she's my ex-wife, and I will regret that for the rest of my life. But it was her unwillingness to give up. That doesn't mean she wasn't frustrated and challenged on more than one occasion, but she was a trooper, and I would not have been as successful as I was without her.
And the name of the book, when it comes out after they get approved by the CIA, is going to be called?
Humint for Humanity.
Humint for Humanity.
So human is short for human intelligence. And this is the book for everybody to read, which I hope will inspire young people to look at the Peace Corps. Are there other ways for them to do something in their life? Can they join the Peace Corps? Can they join the CIA? Do they want to travel overseas? You know, are there other ways that we can cut the umbilical cord, which is something we're not really great at in this country?
Not anymore, are we?
No, that went away with the Vietnam War, unfortunately.
Yeah, you're very true. Well, you know, I just want to throw up some pictures. Here's a picture of you. I think that might have been the event where we met with
yes,
your wife there.
That's yes, sir.
A great picture. I had a great conversation with her as well. Anna, right? Is that her name?
Yes, and she remembers.
Yes, it was a great conversation. Really enjoyed talking to her. She was fantastic. And then here is a picture of you with a dear friend of mine. Kevin Sorbo, very, very special human being. I worked 2 movies with him. Now,
he's in Mar-a-Lago.
That's in Mar-a-Lago. Excellent. Yeah, he's a great guy. We did 2 great movies up in Canada, and hopefully we're going to do some more in the future. Love him and his family. As we get to the close of the show, I'm going to let you finish up. Anything, you know, once your book comes out, of course, I'll share it. I'll have you back on. We'll talk about the book and we'll go more into detail. So you're due for episode 2 with you in the future. But I'll let you close out the show and then I'll finish it.
So I would close out by taking my hat off to all the hardworking CIA officers and employees and staff that labor away in Northern Virginia. It's not that it's they're unappreciated. It's hard work. And most Americans, they see what's on TV, and that's completely wrong. Like I said, Argo is one of the best examples that does reflect some accuracy. But I have to take my hat off to all of the hardworking people that supported me. I had a great, great, great team supporting me when I was overseas. They do fantastic jobs. They're considered government employees, so they get the benefits and yet the costs of doing that. And it's not always appreciated. It's a fantastic team. I think that the American people should be proud of the work that the intelligence agencies writ large do, but especially the young men and women in the CIA.
Well, on that, Jeffrey, thank you so much for being on the show. I know we only touched not even the surface. I don't even know we got to the surface. But, you know, I tried to cover a lot of details. Thank you for taking the time. Thank you for sharing what you shared. Thank you for your service, both in the Peace Corps and your service in the CIA and your service continually, once again, getting back into the fight with what you're doing with Save Our Students and your continued efforts that you're doing in that regard. And I wish you the best with your speaking career. And of course, just say on that, if anybody wants to hire you, you know, I put up before, I'm going to put it up one more time for you, where they can reach you on your website. They can reach you here on your website, and they can email you here if they want to hire you to speak to their corporations, to their companies, to be trained in leadership and communication, all the skill sets that you learned that you'll be able to take their organization through. So definitely reach out. I think you'll learn a lot. You'll probably get a chance to hear some great stories from Jeffrey, and hopefully we'll get to hear some of those stories when we do episode two. Anything else? Otherwise, I'm going to close out the show, Jeffrey.
I'm going to send you the draft version of my book as soon as we finish.
I appreciate it. Thank you. It's been an honor meeting you and your wife at Mindatorium. We had a great time, and I appreciate you. And of course, we'll be working in the future on in Mindatorium as well. So you have a great rest of your day, and I'll see you next time.
Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas to you as well. All right. So I hope today's show with Jeffrey inspired you to live with passion, to pursue your dreams, to go on the adventure, to serve like he did in the Peace Corps or in the CIA, or find a way to serve in your community, serve in your church, serve in your synagogue, serve wherever you can. Service is what it's about in life. And if you find a way to serve, you'll have a better life, because the secret to living is giving. And if you haven't seen my previous 88 podcasts with some of my amazing, courageous friends sharing their powerful stories of overcoming all odds and going on to live powerful lives and making a difference in the world, you can watch them on John Duffy Live Courageously, live-courageously.com, or on my YouTube channel, Live Courageously. So join me now every Wednesday at 6 p.m. for another courageous guest. And I encourage you to choose to live courageously and make your life a masterpiece. And God bless you until we meet next week.